All right. Welcome back to another Throttle Up radio show and podcast. I'm your host, Captain Kevin Smith, and glad to be here for another show. Glad to be part of the Red State Talk Radio lineup as well. And, of course, we have a podcast which you can access very easily with very little skills. I have very little skills in terms of modern digital devices. So it's actually pretty easy to get. Even someone like me can access the podcast without too much trouble. And then you can take it with you, or you can listen to it at any time. Some of these episodes are worth listening to again because we try to make things relevant and interesting and appropriate and informative and educational. We try to inform and inspire. We try to create a mindset that represents what I call a can-do attitude. We're not going to give in. We're not going to give up. This is not who we are, and this is not what we are about. We're not going to do that. And the other thing that we are not going to do, which may be quite different, is we're not going to tell you what to think. That's not the purpose of the show. If you'd like to listen to shows like that, then there are lots of others to choose from. This show and podcast is not going to tell you what to think. It's going to tell you how to think. So that's how we frame everything. We frame our arguments. We frame our process of inquiry and discovery. We frame everything in terms that represents things that may help you consider, may help you understand how to think. And that's the key to success, to learn how to think. Now, learning how to think actually is a lifelong process. It doesn't stop. It continues as long as you and I live. It's really an exciting journey, because once you get on this journey that we call the journey of inquiry and discovery, once you get on this train, you can think of it as a train, automobile, or an airplane, if you will. I kind of like airplanes. I used to fly them for a living for much of my life. Once you get on this vehicle that's traveling, that we call life, this journey is exciting if you are constantly learning how to think. Remember, things that relate to the specifics of the here and now, they don't last very long. I know that sometimes it's a little bit hard to believe. Sometimes it's actually a little bit outside the box for many people. But our net worth as human beings is not determined by what we know. Our net worth as human beings is determined by how we can know. And as we enter into new eras, as we enter into new dimensions, what do we bring with us? We bring with us the ability to think critically. And that enables us to figure out how to think. If you ask me in a nutshell, well, how do you think, Kevin? Then my response would be, well, I think critically. That's how I think. I employ some of the key features of critical thinking. There are numerous ways to do that, and there are all kinds of fine points associated with that. But the big picture is this. The big picture is to recognize that we all need to know how to think, and we need, if we have not been taught how to think, then we need to teach ourselves. I would go so far as to say that most of us have never been taught by others through any kind of formal course of instruction how to think. And that's unfortunately true, but nevertheless, we need to take that and recognize that now it is our responsibility to learn how to think. And my position is this, and I said this many times before, we are entering into a new age here, this new age of discovery, this new, some people call it the new awakening. We are moving through this valley of tears and this fog that is obscuring our vision. And we're rising up to a higher level where we have much better visibility. And as we do that, we bring with us the ability to think critically. If you know how to think critically, then teach it to others. If you don't know how to think critically, then learn. The ability to think critically is no longer an option. If we are going to emerge from this cloud bank, if we are going to emerge from this fog bank, then we need to be able to think critically. We need to be able to know how to think about important things in our lives, important things in the lives of our community, and important things in the lives of our country. We have to be able to do that. And so we are now engaged in this ongoing series. This is actually a special edition, and we've been doing this for a while because we have got a lot of things that we have to deal with respect to what we're discussing in this series. The discussion in this series of radio shows and podcast is the truth algorithm. We are constructing, as we speak, a algorithmic process. Or another way of saying that, we are discussing from a theoretical basis, from a theoretical perspective that employs critical thinking, how to determine if, in fact, something that claims to be true is true. When we input the claim into our truth algorithm, and we can think of that as a physical mechanism. It's actually conceptual, but it doesn't have to remain that way. It can be an app. It can be employed utilizing modern electronic devices, of course, and eventually, I'm sure it will. But right now, we can think of it metaphorically as some kind of a device. When we input some claim, and we'll call it that. We'll say, okay, this is an assertion. This is a claim that this, whatever it is in fact true. It is in fact real. It is in fact realistic. It is in fact viable, and it's part of the actual accurate model of reality. Our model of reality needs to accurately reflect what is actually real. Our understanding of the truth needs to be as accurate as possible, recognizing that we are all humans and we all have some limitations, but we don't need to consider that as much as the fact is that we have the ability to know if, in fact, something is true. Now, just because somebody else wants us to believe that something is true does not mean that we have to accept it. It means that we have to then activate our own thinking mechanism. We are going to think for ourselves. We are not going to be told how to think. We are going to learn how to think by ourselves. We are not going to be told what to think. We are going to determine what to think based upon our ability to understand how we should think about such and such first and foremost. We don't actually jump to a conclusion. We consider the question, how should I think about this, when we have been, or when I have been presented with such and such information. Now, here's the thing that might be helpful as we begin our discussion this week. We can think of ourselves as a cognitive radio, if you will, a transmitter and receiver. Our minds, our cognitive apparatus, can be thought of as a transmitter and receiver of information. Okay, and so we have the switches in the on position. It's in the TR position. That stands for transmit and receive. Okay, and we are then able to receive information and then transmit it on to others. Now let's talk about the reception first of all. All right, so we have been given information. So someone is transmitting information to us. It could be in all kinds of ways. It could be a carrier pigeon. In today's world, it's done wirelessly and digitally pretty much across the world. And so, yes, we are in a mobile digital world, and we typically will receive information that way. Another human is sending it to us. Typically, it's another human. It doesn't necessarily have to be, but often it is. Another human being is, in fact, transmitting that information to us, and we are receiving it because we have our reception devices activated, where our ears are functioning, our brain is turned on, it is functioning, we are receiving this information. Now, this is raw information that we are receiving. It is raw data, if you will, okay? raw data is not actually the thing that we act upon. We take this this initial information and we put it through a number of processes to determine if in fact it is real, if in fact it is valid, and if in fact that it is something that is believable. Most of what we receive, not everything, of course, but most of what we receive are assertions or attempted statements of fact or propositions that are presenting us with what is being declared as the truth. This is a declaration that this is in fact true. This piece of information is in fact the truth. And now it's up to us to determine, and that is our own responsibility. We are sovereign thinkers, and that is our responsibility, and we need to take that on very, very seriously. It's our responsibility to determine if, in fact, this assertion, this claim that purports itself to be true, is it, in fact, true? Now, you can say, well, we're hopeless here because we are stuck, on this dilemma that unless we get further information from other sources, we are not going to be able to determine whether or not it's true. Okay, now, I just said something that I hope you understand, but I'm going to kind of go outside the box here. I'm going to say, no, we don't necessarily need to wait for further information. There's a lot of other things that we can do. And you may think that I've lost my mind now. You may think that I have completely gone bonkers. That, oh, Kevin has lost it. He is now in some kind of alternate universe. He actually thinks that we can consider, or there are things for us to consider while we are wondering whether or not this assertion that claims to be true is in fact true. And that's what I'm dealing with now. I'm dealing with claims. Is this claim a factual, accurate, is it a truthful assertion? If somebody wants me to believe something is true, is it in fact true? Or alternatively, is it in fact propaganda? Now, it's either, if it is being put forward, I know there's lots of ways that we can look at this. But here's my take on it. If something is being put forward, something is being transmitted out there for others to pick up on, and it is making a claim, it is making an assertion that this is in fact true, do we then determine on our own, by ourselves, whether or not this is in fact true, or do we determine that this claim is suspect and it could very well be not the truth at all? It could very well be propaganda. Propaganda is trying to get you to believe in something that is in fact not true. Propaganda is in fact the falsification of reality. Propaganda is trying to get you to believe something that is, in fact, objectively untrue. It is objectively false. It is it objectively does not exist, or it does not belong in the truth category. It belongs either in a rumor, or it belongs in the category that are called lies. The big lie is, of course, something that the propaganda is fully engaged in putting forward the big lies. The big lies that can alter the consciousness of a society, alter the consciousness of a group of people. We are the propaganda machine is trying to alter your consciousness. The propaganda machine is trying to get you to believe something that is objectively not true. To believe something is true that actually is in fact not true. It is false. It is a lie. It is a distortion. It is a deception. That's what propaganda is. It's up to us to determine if in fact something that is claims to be true is true. That is what our job is. Now, that's what this whole show is about, is this claim of something that is claims to be true is in fact the truth. Okay, so we are going to now listen to this is a audio clip of a news report. This comes from it's a Fox News piece. Kaylee McInerney is heading up this discussion group, and it's actually talking about something that was claimed to be true that turned out not to be upon further investigation. I'm going to use this as a jumping off point to get to my point here, as there's lots of things that we can do before the final facts have been determined. We can make some preliminary assessments. We can make some pretty good evaluations by ourselves as we explore our ability to consider how we should think about this truth algorithm, how we should think about determining on our own whether or not something that claims to be true is in fact true. All right, so let's listen to this.
Fox News alerts: the liberal media and Democrats caught pushing a false narrative yet again. Surprise, surprise. After an inspector general report debunks claims that then President Trump ordered protesters to be cleared from Lafayette Park outside the White House last summer for a photo op. That was never the case. This is Outnumbered. I'm Kaylee McEnany, and here today, my co-hosts Harris Faulkner and Emily Campagno, Fox News contributor Leslie Marshall, and joining us in the virtual center seat for the very first time, my former colleague and friend, Ben Ferguson, host of the Ben Ferguson podcast. Welcome all. We're now learning that police cleared Lafayette Park before they knew about President Trump's plans last June to walk through the park and pose in front of St. John's Church with a Bible, a church protesters had tried to burn down the previous night. The IG found that park police cleared the park to allow for new fencing to be installed. The report concludes, quote, "The evidence showed that the U.S. Park Police did not know about the president's potential movement until mid to late afternoon on June 1st, hours after it had been developing its operational plan and the fencing contractor had arrived in the park." Stunning. But at the time, major news outlets were in a fury, saying President Trump actually ordered the tear gassing of protesters.
If the White House president and his team had to do it all over again, Would you have gassed and pummeled protesters to clear the park so the president could have a photo op?
Cleared away protesters using tear gas and rubber bullets so that Donald Trump could walk across the street from the White House and stage a photo op in front of a church with an upside-down Bible.
The president wanted this photo op, and he wanted to disperse that crowd because he is, he wants an image of this, all of these protests being one thing, which is violent, which, of course, is not accurate.
Why were they ordered to move on protesters at that moment? Obviously, the president wanted a photo op.
Ben, coming to you, welcome, first of all. I fielded that question from Jim Acosta from the podium. I told him that wasn't the case, but Jim Acosta, ever so lean on the facts, did not care about the facts. Neither did the Washington Post, who compared Lafayette Square to Tiananmen Square. The Washington Post, their timeline was up for awards for their reporting on Lafayette Square. This is stunning. The New York Times had eight people on their byline, eight reporters, confirming the story that we now know to be false. This is stunning.
Well, they wanted to push a narrative that this president was so psychotic that he was willing to attack his own American citizens for a photo op. They also forgot to tell you that before this happened, you had 49 park police officers that had already been injured by these non-peaceful protesters. But again, you go back to that question from Jim Acosta that I think is just perfect. Quote, would you have gassed or pummeled protesters if you had it to do it all over again to clear the park so the president could have a photo op? It wasn't a photo op. They had already planned to get this area secure because so many park police had been injured and they needed to put up new barriers to make sure people couldn't scale them to protect the White House grounds and also to protect the Secret Service. This was a national security issue. And look at this church. They don't even care about the church, for goodness sakes. A church that's historic, a church that was burned, but this is about the narrative. You had a president they wanted you to think was evil, that hated you, that was paranoid, that was willing to attack American citizens for a photo op. It was all a lie, but this is what we know about this media. They were willing to lie, tell any lie to get Donald Trump out of the White House.
That's exactly right. And they ignored the fact that, as you noted, federal law enforcement was having frozen water bottles and brick thrown at them at this time. But Leslie, coming to you, I want to play a soundbite of Democrats who continued to perpetuate the false leftist media narrative as well. Let's roll tape.
Peaceful protesters dispersed in order for a president from the doorstep of the people's house, the White House, using tear gas and flash grenades in order to stage a photo op in one of the most historic churches in the country.
Just a couple of nights ago, this guy, Donald Trump, who happens to right now be president of the United States, would throw tear gas at people who were peacefully protesting. So he could clear the roads.
Maybe they didn't have tear gas, I don't know, but they had the elements of it for peaceful demonstrators to make way for the president to walk through. What is this, a banana republic?
Biden, Kamala, Pelosi, all wrong, Leslie. Where's the accountability?
Well, if you look historically at politicians, they will often believe what is put out there because, like I've said before, journalists are supposed to report the facts. This is why it's good to have independent investigations, because you get to the truth perhaps after the fact. We've seen that with Iraq and WMDs. We've seen that with Benghazi. And, oh, no, it wasn't Hillary. Even Republicans said, oh, no, it wasn't Hillary. And this time, no, it wasn't Donald Trump. It was the Park Police. But there are two things here, Kaylee. One, the Park Police should have stepped up and said, this was our call, because it was their call. And the president kept getting accused. You even had people asking you that. And somebody from the Park Police, the leader of the Park Police, should have come out and said, hey, this is on us. And secondly, this report does not clear the Park Police for the use of force and the type of response that they had, if you read it in its entirety. I think these types of reports are good. And sadly, they always are after the fact. Hindsight is 20/20. But optics are huge. And if it's not just the media, but if you're watching it on TV and you have this belief, whether it's left to right or right to left, it's easy, even for our elected officials, to jump on board with the same narrative.
Well, Attorney General Barr dispelled that narrative. The press did not care. And Harris, this is a pattern with the press when it comes to reporting on President Trump. Let's put up a full screen that recounts just a few of the media narratives that were wrong. It's incredible. It wasn't just Lafayette Park. They were wrong about Russian bounties on the heads of U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Of course, President Trump was, we were told he completely ignored that, when in fact that intelligence had low or moderate confidence. They were wrong about the COVID origins. They said he was maniacal and crazy for suggesting it could have come from the Wuhan lab. They said we'll never have a vaccine by 2020. Oh, wait, we did. Hunter Biden they ignored until we found out he's under federal investigation. And then the Georgia election call, when the audio came out, the Washington Post had to correct the story.
Look, I think Leslie made some really salient points there. And part of the problem is that journalism and media sometimes don't go together. The news media, the journalists among us are not doing the job of being curious and going asking the public information officer at the Parks Police Department, what really drove you to put people out there? Pete Hegseth just told me last hour he was deployed with the D.C. National Guard, was on the ground there several nights and said, look, it was total chaos. The Parks Police were bringing things out. Like, even he knew from just being there that it was not about a photo op necessarily, but what was unfolding on the ground. But you didn't even get that from the reporters. We had video of this last hour. We had their sound bites from the reporter saying, well, you know what this is. No, we're depending on you to tell us with your good reporting and investigative work what it is, not what you think it is. So that's part of the problem. But there's also the, if you go to cover a fire, but your boss told you before you left the newsroom that it should be a flood, what do you do when you get there and the flames are smoldering? I mean, you can't exactly say it's a flood. So this is almost like them surreptitiously changing the shot so the background is running water. I'll pay no attention to that over there. I mean, it's a dangerous habit to get into because sooner or later, you can't fight the facts. They're stubborn like that. They don't care about our feelings. They will burst eventually. And that is what is happening. And your list, we can put some more stuff on it, but it's only an hour show.
That's exactly right. We could put a whole lot more. And I'm not surprised when you have 79% of independent voters saying they believe that the media makes up fake stories and intentionally reports them. It's incredible. Crisis in journalism, indeed. Emily, I want to share with you something that a former colleague of mine tweeted. His name is Harrison Fields. He was an assistant press secretary, now director of communications for Congressman Byron Donalds. And he tweeted this. It stuck out to me when I read it. As a man of color who proudly served in the Trump administration, I was often asked how I could work for a man that, quote, cleared and pepper sprayed a crowd protesting for civil rights. I told them Trump didn't do that, and they scoffed at me. Turns out the media lied and the White House was correct.
I have nothing to add to that. I think it speaks for itself. And I have to say, too, that there is an element of common sense at the time that was totally ignored, as we now know in the report that the incident commander said, you can't develop a plan like this in 2 minutes. He said the attorney general is a very important man in government, but he's not my boss. So the whole point was that the concept of this actually happening, of the now false narrative that we know to be false actually happening, was really not rooted in common sense at all, that it actually couldn't have happened in that way. And to just add to the long list of media and Democrat high officials that were sort of decrying this at the time, I think it is a worse sin, regardless of the media attempting to serve as a watchdog, which we all know is really false most of the time. I think it's a worse sin for these elected officials to be sitting there in these powerful positions furthering this false narrative, right? Elizabeth Warren, it's sickening. Pelosi, we heard Banana Republic, her and Schumer saying that the president dishonored every value that faith teaches us. Ayanna Pressley at the time calling him the occupant of the White House. She said tear gassed peaceful protesters for a photo op. Horrifying. This man is dishonoring his oath, inciting violence and failing the nation, not to mention now President Joe Biden saying he's using the American military against the American people. He tear gassed peaceful protesters and fired rubber bullets. I wonder if any of these people will correct themselves. Will they come out on the record? Because we know for sure the media won't. We've spoken a lot about amplification versus correction. And my final quick point is just that, you guys, the progressive left, the Democrat Party, they don't care. It doesn't matter how many false narratives that the media, the correct media, debunks, that people come out and say, oh, no, actually, that's not true. They do not care. They will either say, well, he's still a fascist. Oh, he's still orange man bad. Whatever they want to say to fit their own portrayal of this person, of this president, they will continue to force, regardless of the truth, as Harris says, bursting through.
That's right. There's zero accountability, but I can assure our viewers one thing. Here on Outnumbered, you'll see a whole...
Okay, so now that's really an important thing for us to consider. This is a real life event. It's not hypothetical or theoretical. This actually happened, and this is a thorough examination and description of the perpetration of lies, the falsification of reality, the unabashed propaganda that went on and on and on about an event relating to the awfulness of a particular person, undesirability of his administration, the unbridled hatred of President Donald Trump, and on and on and on. You can see here that we have from multitude of sources, we have the representation of exactly the same thing. They wanted us to believe something that was patently untrue, that was false, that was a lie, that was nothing more than propaganda. Now, keep in mind, this is a very important point I'm going to make. You notice it did not come from a single source. This propaganda came from multiple sources that were saying the same awful thing about a person and his group. Multiple sources were saying the same thing, were putting forward exactly the same lie, were putting forward the same false narrative, were creating something that was completely untrue. Nevertheless, they wanted us to believe that it, in fact, was true. All right, so what do? We are not hopeless. We do not have to just stand by and wait for the Inspector General's report. There's a lot of things that we can do. And one of the commentators was really touching on exactly the same thing that I'm talking about. I know this is a little bit, this is certainly serendipity and a little bit scary too, but this other commentator, the last one or next to the last one, I think was talking about, does it pass the common sense test? And it clearly did not. And here we can begin to use something that we have available to all of us. And that's what I want you to understand. That's what this whole series of shows is all about. We have something that we can use. We have a built-in defense mechanism against propaganda. In general terms, that happens to be critical thinking. Critical thinking is a powerful weapon against propaganda. The other thing is intellectual courage and self-confidence that we can use our power of discernment to look at something and say, does this actually make sense? Now, here are four things that we can check off as part of our critical thinking toolkit. All right, and this is good to write this down. Put it in your daily diary. It is imagination goes first and foremost. Imagination, intuition, followed by innovation and creativity. Let's activate all of those things. So let's not be timid about it. Let's go ahead and activate those attributes, those cognitive mechanisms that enable us to perform at a very high level. Higher order reasoning is our gift that we give ourselves. And let's present that in gift package form. Here is your ability to engage in higher order reasoning. We give that gift to ourselves. We can use that to make value judgments on something as we wait for the final determination. We can give it some kind of an initial value. How does this comply with our ability to make these cognitive preliminary determinations of something? If something basically doesn't feel right, if something doesn't feel right, it most likely is not right. If something just doesn't seem to pass the smell test, if something just does not seem to fit, if something is suspicious, remember, be skeptical. A good advice from Dr. Ruiz of the Five Agreements. Be skeptical is one of the keys to a productive life. All right, we have one more clip. This is pretty important, and this relates to what we're trying to deal with. I know we're trying to squeeze in a lot today because there's a lot of things to talk about, but this is really good. This is going to help us help us better evoke these higher order cognitive attributes that I want to bring to bear on whether or not something that claims to be true is in fact true.
Do not be too timid and squeamish about your actions. All life is an experiment. The more experiments you make, the better. There is perhaps no task we can set before ourselves that offers greater rewards than striving for mastery of the world within. For no matter what has happened to us thus far, nor what may befall us in the future, greater inner harmony can only improve our well-being. This task is also unique in that it requires no additional resources to begin, no help from others, and it can be worked towards at any place and at any time. As we saw in our previous video, all that is required is a willingness to experiment and a knowledge of some of the tools we have at our disposal. In this video, and several to follow, we will explore a variety of these tools, and we will look at how to integrate them into life experiments that can help us unlock a more flourishing state of mind. The first tool we are going to examine is cognitive reframing. Cognitive reframing is a method for self-induced thought change. It can be used for many purposes, such as minimizing the impact of intrusive thoughts, correcting the faulty beliefs that give rise to irrational fears, or even escaping the downward pull of depressive ruminations. When implemented successfully, cognitive reframing shifts us away from thought patterns that make us suffer to those more conducive to a good life. In this video, we are going to explore how we can use cognitive reframing to restructure our attitude. For our attitude is very often what keeps us locked in a stagnant life of suffering, and our attitude is one element of the world within that can be modified to a remarkable degree. If we are to have any hope of achieving this type of transformation, we need to accept that our current attitude is not a singularly accurate product of our life thus far. It is easy to overlook this fact and to believe that a poor attitude on our part is justified by what we have had to endure. A difficult upbringing, mistreatment by others, or plain bad luck can easily convince us that our attitude, while perhaps not ideal, is based on the reality of our situation. This belief, however, overlooks two important considerations. Firstly, humans are susceptible to all sorts of biases, prone to self-deception, and capable of the greatest delusions. But even if we were to grant that much of what sculpted our attitude is based in fact, and not on our distorted view of these facts, This brings up the following set of questions. Which facts? Why those facts? And why not others? For as William James put it, the world is a blooming, buzzing confusion, and for order to emerge, whether it be the order of a scientific theory, or the order that creates our sense of self and our attitude toward life, we must be selective about which facts we focus on, which ones we diminish, and which ones we completely ignore. Or as Arthur Koestler explains, without the hard little bits of marble which are called facts or data, one cannot compose a mosaic. What matters, however, are not so much of the individual bits, but the successive patterns into which you arrange them, then break them up and rearrange them. Our past may be the source material from which the foundation of our attitude was built, but this material can be sculpted in many ways, and cognitive reframing can help us achieve this feat. For to reframe is simply to create new patterns of self-order by changing the way we perceive the facts of our life and by changing the way we string these facts together. To reframe means to change the conceptual and/or emotional setting or viewpoint in relation to which a situation is experienced, and to place it in another frame which fits the facts of the same concrete situation equally well or even better, and thereby changes its entire meaning. The mechanism involved here is not immediately obvious, especially if we bear in mind that there is change, while the situation itself may remain quite unchanged and, indeed, even unchangeable. What turns out to be changed as a result of reframing is the meaning attributed to the situation, and therefore its consequences, but not its concrete facts. We are now going to look at how we can integrate cognitive reframing into a life experiment that can help us cultivate a more empowered attitude. The first step in this experiment is to begin with the end in mind. We should ask ourselves the following questions. Who would we like to be? What do we value? And what do we want out of life? We should write out our answers, as this exercise and the ones to follow will be more effective if we put pen to paper. With our end in mind, we then need to ask if there is anything about ourselves or this world that absolutely precludes this possibility. If no insurmountable barriers exist, then we have formed what the psychologist William James called a living option. With our living option in mind, the next step is to make use of an exercise called mental contrasting. This entails writing out how we see our life unfolding if we remain as we are now, in contrast to how our life will become if we move toward the ideal of our living option. This exercise will not only increase our awareness of the necessity of change and the good that will befall us if we do change, but it will also create a heightened emotional state, which can make the next step of this experiment more effective. For as Michael Mahoney writes in Human Change Processes, it is in the crucibles of personally meaningful, intense emotions that patterns of experiencing may be most powerfully rescaffolded. Or as Arnold Bennett put it, there can be no knowledge without emotion. We may be aware of the truth, yet until we have felt its force, it is not ours. To the cognition of the brain must be added the experience of the soul. With the experience of our soul supporting us, we will be psychologically primed to reinterpret our past in a way that justifies a more empowered attitude. One exercise that can help us in this regard is to write out a brief life narrative, which frames the events of our past in such a way that at the end of the narrative, we are firmly planted on the path of our living option. This exercise, in other words, uses our desired future to reshape our conception of the past in the recognition that what an individual seeks to become determines what he remembers of his has been. In this sense, the future determines the past. An example can clarify the process of reframing. Perhaps we are an individual who has spent years drifting through life, accomplishing little to be proud of and trapped in an attitude of apathy and despondency. To escape from this state of mind, we do not need to deny our past, but we do need to look at it from a different angle. Instead of seeing our years as wasted, we can focus on what experiencing life in this form has taught us. We have learned the danger of drifting, the necessity of a more active approach, and the ease with which the years can pass us by. This experience could be interpreted as the spark of necessity that lit the fuse of a more empowered existence, and these wasted years could be reinterpreted as setting the stage for redemption. The process of revising a life story is not one of denying facts, wrote Michael Mahoney, diminishing the reality of past suffering or, to put it graphically, blowing sunshine up the ass. It is, however, an exploration of alternative interpretations and evaluations. As we strive to resculpt the foundation of our attitude with cognitive reframing, we need to recognize that such change will not be accomplished in a single sitting. It takes time to cultivate the new thought patterns that support a more empowered view of life, and for this reason, we should consider developing a journaling habit. With this habit in place, each day we have an opportunity to challenge the thought patterns holding us back and to write out more empowering interpretations of life. Many great figures, both past and present, have found such a habit to be of great value. Francis Bacon, the 16th century English polymath, was so fond of this personal form of correspondence that he proclaimed, "Let diaries, therefore, be brought in use." Tom Morrison's book True Success points out that when we consistently use a journal, we are interpreting to ourselves the directions of our lives, our pasts, presents, and futures, small details and big developments. We are attaining clarity about our own hearts, arriving at self-knowledge as well as knowledge of the world. Our goals for work, for family life, and for personal development naturally grow out of this knowledge as a powerful byproduct of our habits of articulation. If we are persistent in our use of writing to challenge who we think we are and where we think we are going, slowly but surely we will alter the way we view the world, and we will give birth to a new attitude. If we are truly successful in our endeavor, this process of cognitive reframing can be equivalent to a change of our gods. For as the Roman poet Virgil wrote, "We make our destiny by our choice of the gods," and the same can be said with regards to our choice of attitude. Our attitude determines our destiny. It tells us what is possible and what is not. But unlike the gods, who can seem out of reach to us mere mortals, our attitude can change, and as William James wrote, "The greatest discovery of my generation is the fact that human beings can alter their lives by altering their attitudes of mind."
Okay, so that is, again, from the Academy of Ideas, and it's a great discussion, as many of them are. But this relates to what we're trying to deal with here. And in a general sense, I'm trying to make the point that our power of reason is more powerful than we can imagine. Our powerful of reason enables us to engage in cognitive reframing if necessary. It also enables us to engage in this higher order thinking that can begin to reveal to us what is the truth. What is the truth of the matter? We can get to a point where we have this powerful tool that we have described as intuition, imagination, and stuff like that, this powerful tool at our disposal. And we can begin to use that as a process, as a way of how to think about something such that we want to be able to determine if the claim that it is true is in fact true. In the example given, did President Trump utilize tear gas and flash bombs to clear a way for a personal photo op, or did he not? Okay, so I'm looking at the clock, and it's telling me that, yes, we are at the end of another Throttle Up Radio show. Great to be here. See you all next week.